Hello and welcome to the Majlis Radio for Europe Liberties Current Affairs podcast focusing on Central Asia. I am Mohammed Tahir, the host of the Majlis podcast and Radio for Europe Liberties media manager here in Washington, D.C. A group of Central Asia watchers is launching a new project they say aims to draw attention to underreported subjects in Central Asia and to strengthen networks of knowledge transfer among a wide range of people and institutions. It's called the Oxus Society, the official launch of which is expected on September 28. Once launched, among others, the Society plans to publish reports, databases, organize public events, in other words, do everything to keep Central Asia in the headlines. And that's what we do in the Majlis podcast, so we thought why not to invite the founders of the project to learn more about the initiative, their objectives, challenges and opportunities, and more importantly, how is this NGO different than those which are already active. And also, we will touch upon some of the immediate projects they have in mind in ways in which it might relate to our audience. So without further ado, let me welcome Edward Lemon, the president of the Oxus Society, also research assistant professor at the Bush School, Shir Hashimov, an independent researcher focusing on Central Asia with special interest in his native Tajikistan, Niva Yao, researcher at the OSCE Academy in Bishkek, who's originally from Hong Kong, and Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberties, Central Asia blog, Kishlok Awazi. Thank you, colleagues, for joining us. So, Edward, congratulations on this project, and also congratulations on your new assignment at the Bush School. I guess while we were busy with the COVID-19, a lot was happening in your world. So great to have you. I guess we will start the conversation with the project, Edward. So the Oxus Society, tell us about it. What is it?
So thank you, Mohammed, for having me today. So the Oxus Society was founded in Washington, D.C. in April. Although, as you mentioned, we're not launching the initiative fully until 2 weeks' time in late September. It's a nonprofit organization. It's a nonpartisan organization. Although we're based in Washington, D.C., obviously in the era of the pandemic, most of our events and outreach will be virtual. And so, you know, this maybe is one of the upsides of the pandemic is the fact that it, for the community of scholars working on and in Central Asia, you know, there's an opportunity to engage more regularly on a virtual basis and bring sort of scholars together to discuss the region in a virtual format. Inspired the founding of the organization, it was sort of a desire to increase the diversity in the field. I think in many cases, you know, those who are offering their expertise are the same people we've heard from time and time again. Mm. And I think there's always a need to bring in new voices, you know, voices from a younger generation of scholars, many of whom are spending considerable amounts of time in the region and have real fresh and original insights to offer. And so part of our mission at the Oxus Society is to give a platform to those individuals.
Right.
And that's why we founded a researcher directory, which is going to be a searchable database of experts working on a whole range of topics. You know, so the idea with the directory is to, you know, have a resource that will be available to journalists, journal editors, people looking for panelists, you know, to really spotlight new voices working on Central Asia. Mm.
So the idea is also, besides the database that you are talking about, you are going to publish reports and planning to organize public events, discussions about issues in Central Asia that you think needs more attention. So any specific kind of a thematic focus that you will be prioritizing?
Yeah, I think, you know, our focus is relatively broad, as you say, but we're sort of interested in the changing dynamics of the region. And that's partly, you know, another reason we want to bring in new voices is because so much is changing in the region, be it with, you know, the changes that are taking place in Uzbekistan since the death of Islam Karimov in 2016, the resurgent sense of regionalism, you know, the rise of China in the region. And that's why sort of we thought that this was an apt moment to launch a new organization. We're also including within our definition of the region Xinjiang, what was historically known as East Turkestan, you know, both because the links between the region were historically stronger than they are today, but also because they're also re-emerging through the issues such as, you know, responses from Central Asian populations, particularly in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, to what's going on in Xinjiang. And so, you know, we observed that the scholars working on Xinjiang are often sort of not always in sort of full communication and collaboration with those working on the post-Soviet area of Central Asia. And so we really want to try and bridge those divides, you know, to come with a very productive dialogue between those working on China, Xinjiang on the one hand, and on Central Asia on the other.
share in NEPA. First of all, tell us what role you guys are playing in this project. And I think in terms of NEPA, earlier we were talking with Edward. NEPA, you are going to be doing lots of writing, I guess, for this organization, as you do to lots of other platforms. So first, share, and then NEPA, please tell us how you have been involved and going to be involved in the future with this organization.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on this podcast. For now, I have been closely working with Ed and several other researchers on the data set of protests in Central Asia, spanning the period from 2020 to 2018, and basically figuring out a way to find this information, to put it in a centralized data set and present it in a way that has not been done before. And I guess in the future, Ed and I and several other researchers who worked on this data set will be co-authoring reports, you know, present the protests, present the trends that we can find in those protests, as well as some basic statistical analysis and descriptive analysis of those protests.
And NEPA, what about you?
Well, first of all, happy to be on the podcast, and I'm really excited for the OSIS Society because my work based in Bishkek mainly is on, I'm on a mission to document all the Chinese activities and make sense of China's role in this region. I'm really looking forward to, you know, the OSIS, you know, researcher database because, you know, if I'm looking at working with someone in Tajikistan, for example, on a specific topic, I mean, this would just, you know, save much more time. The project that I'm working on for the OSIS Society at the moment is a project on the presence of Chinese private security in Central Asia. I come from a background that is, you know, strictly about Chinese foreign policy. But when I came to Central Asia, I, you know, wanted to understand what is China doing in Central Asia, you know, to bring transparency to the region. But in doing so, you know, I want to use what is China doing in Central Asia to make sense of China in general. So I go back and forth with, you know, my kind of observations in Bishkek and, you know, elsewhere in Central Asia, and then also observing what is happening in China. So one trend in recent years in China is that the Chinese government has been pushing a lot of different strategies to protect Chinese projects overseas, commercial projects. And amongst many of those strategies, one of them is really pushing private Chinese security companies to go abroad. And this is part of a whole process of defunding the Chinese military, in which you pushed a lot of former soldiers and military personnel into the private sector. And some of these companies have gone into Central Asia as well. And in this project, we documented six of them that have strong evidence indicating them offering services in, you know, different countries in Central Asia. The products that they offer are different in different countries because they are limited by the local rules, which, you know, I think is really important to highlight because it shows that China is, you know, following the local rules, which means that local rules can be changed, targeting, you know, specific, you know, issues with these companies, like, you know, Kyrgyzstan offering a weapon license for these companies, for example. You know, if China is following the rules, then, you know, we can kind of, you know, push for these rules to be changed so that we can minimize the potential, you know, problems that might emerge from a, you know, situation where, you know, a Chinese private security company can run around with, you know, weapons. So in this particular project, I documented all the Chinese Communist Party's specific strategies to push these companies to go abroad. And this is quite new as well in, you know, just the overall academic space. Inside or outside Central Asia.
When this report is coming out?
In a few weeks.
Okay.
Ed, is that right?
Yeah, no, so we're hoping once we finalize the report, it will be going on our website, I would say, you know, shortly after launch.
Now, this is a very important project. I think we have discussed a little bit about this issue in our previous episodes. We are really looking forward to reading this report, NEPA. Thank you very much. So, Bruce, actually, you are invited to jump in anytime you would like to. And just going back to Edward here, Edward, your site, which is still under construction, I guess, you also say that the project aims to establish avenues to foster academic exchange between Central Asia and the West. Tell us about what does this paragraph means. I mean, who you have in mind as a potential partner in Central Asia? Are they individuals? Are they institutions? And how you aim to establish that?
Yeah, I think person-to-person exchange, personal connections that can be fostered through, the creation of our researcher directory is maybe our primary focus. We're certainly interested in forming partnerships with specific institutions, and we already have a number of partnerships in the making here in the United States, and we're certainly interested in expanding partnerships in Central Asia. But we feel that, having this network of scholars where we hope to have, a series of internal events, research symposia where people can present their research, maybe articles for publication, book chapters, et cetera, and then receive feedback from their peers, sessions to help individuals who are looking to publish maybe in an English language academic journal or an English language media publication. I think we want to have a sort of, a series of sort of events that help foster a community of scholars and also, foster sort of useful exchanges between individuals. Another important thing that I want to sort of point out is that we're very keen to ensure that, hierarchical relations of knowledge production, that when research is often exploitative and it's that the senior, often Western researchers that are coming into the country using field assistants and then leaving the country and effectively using the research that was conducted by others and putting it in their name, we're very keen to break down those relationships. And so we're in our reports and work with on the protest data, working with Share amongst two other researchers from Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan, we're going to have full co-authorship in any reports that are produced from the data set that we produce together. We think that's only fair. Certainly interested in sort of creating equitable exchanges rather than exploitative ones.
It's very, very important. And also earlier you sent me a memo describing this project. In that, one aspect kind of draw my attention, which was emphasized that the Oxus will be a platform where critical thinking, independence of thought, and academic freedom will be promoted. I just wanted to get your thoughts on that. I mean, there is a little tolerance, if any, among Central Asian authorities for anything like this. So I thought, how you imagine doing that?
Yeah, no, I think obviously critical thinking is important for any sort of democratic society. And I think, our interest is obviously to do no harm, and people will obviously participate as they, to the extent they see fit, whereas as active participants or as observers, people can use pseudonyms, et cetera, et cetera. People, I know a number of people who are interested in following the project but don't feel happy joining the directory. We're very happy for those people to be included within the network without divulging their contact details publicly. And so, it's obviously the safety and of members of our research network is obviously of prime importance. But I think at the same time, we're very interested in having sort of more debates. And I feel like there's a little bit too much groupthink often on panels regarding, key issues in the region. And so, I'd be very interested in sort of having debates around, key issues in the region, including, whether in what ways the sort of China's role in the region is positive or negative. Is secular governance a form of governance that provides stability, or does it threaten individuals? There are key discussions and debates that I think are happening, but, not always sort of seeping out into, the English language media for a broader audience. We're certainly very interested in organizing constructive debates where people can exchange opinions rather than sort of inviting speakers who, will all agree with a sort of one viewpoint, right, maybe a Western-centric viewpoint, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. At this stage, I think, Bruce, anything you would like to add into the discussion? Of course, feel free to ask questions to our speakers.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. I was just wondering, you've talked about the exchange of ideas, and certainly I'm sympathetic to how many people in Central Asia have done a lot of hard work and gotten very little credit for it. But how do you reach out to these kind of people? I'm kind of curious. Have you got to that stage yet? I mean, I know you haven't launched your website, but are you planning on doing anything on social networks, like to advertise your existence? And clearly, there's some restrictions early on, financial restrictions. You can't hire people to do translating from all these languages. But are you considering in the future, if everything goes well, that you would use other Central Asian languages or languages from the region on your website and take in contributions from people writing in those languages? Because a lot of them can't write English very well or at all, but yet they can make great contributions. So I was curious about that.
No, thank you. They're very relevant questions. And, we've already established our social media presence on Twitter, and so started to, connect with various people in that way. Initially, our sort of researcher directory was based on sort of going through our own personal networks and, compiling lists based on, publicly available profiles of researchers. And I want to stress that our concept of researcher doesn't necessarily mean you have to be a PhD or have a PhD, you know, don't have to be a traditional academic. You can be, you know, just have a master's degree. And if you're publishing research on the region, like Neva and Shara, for example, you know, we're definitely very happy to welcome you into our organization. In terms of local languages, we've already translated the About Us section into the five local languages, six local languages, including Uyghur and Russian. And, you know, in an ideal world, we would hope that in the future we would be able to translate a number of our articles into local languages and not just Russian. So that's certainly something we're hoping for and planning in the future. Mm-hmm. And at this point, we welcome contributions, and we've had a number of contributions already in Russian that we will translate into English, and even one contribution in Uzbek. A book review of Otkun Kundla, the newly published English translation of the book by Kodidi.
So what kind of contribution you are hoping to get or you accept from people who might be interested in it? I mean, is it a kind of article? It's an academic article? It's a book? It's what is it? What's the nature of those contributions should be?
We're going to publish shorter articles, 1,000 to 1,200 words. You know, these would be articles that were maybe a reflection on an experience with field work, for example, or how COVID-19 was affecting ability to do research, or a sort of opinion piece, again, based on sort of hopefully, you know, an original analysis, for example, of the rise of China's tech diplomacy. Chinese tech companies are, you know, engaging in offering scholarships, et cetera, to Central Asian students, you know, so a broad range of topics, you know, for shorter articles, like lengthier research reports, and also book reviews. So they're the sort of three main sorts of contribution.
And also, maybe I should involve Shir here. Yes, contribution is what Edward is dealing with, but also in terms of this establishing this network of contacts in the region, the database. So once you reached out to your contacts, perhaps as a part of the organization as you are, what kind of reaction you would get from people in response to your invitation, either to join the organization in this or other form, or make a contribution, or to be listed as an expert? Tell us about the reaction you got from any communications you might have with people on the ground.
Well, that's certainly an interesting question. I did reach out to several of my friends who are currently based in Dushanbe in Tajikistan, who are graduates of OSCE Academy in Bishkek or other institutions sponsored by Western donors. And, you know, I explained to them what OXO Society aims to do and asked whether they would like to join as, you know, local experts. And I think one of the dominant sentiments that I hear from my contacts on the ground is sort of cautiousness, wanting to first see what sort of the research OXIS will do, only because, as have been mentioned earlier in the conversation, Central Asian governments are not exactly keen on critical thinking and narratives that oppose the dominant narrative on the ground. So I guess the contacts that I spoke to, they first want to see what sort of research, what sort of topics are going to be raised by OXIS before deciding whether they can afford, for personal reasons, to have their names to be, you know, associated with such a project. Certainly, there's a lot of desire to be part of such a promising initiative, but for personal reasons, there are certain reservations on the ground.
Maybe now we are perhaps talking about some of the challenges that every organization faces when it comes to working in Central Asia. Edward, coming back to you, the information that you shared with me, I also realized that you have a number of high-profile Central Asia watchers in the society under different structure. Here I'm especially referring to the advisory board members that you have listed. But one thing that attracted me in the list was those are, of course, highly respected Central Asia experts, but almost all of them resides in the West. And few Central Asians who were included also lives in the West. So is it by design? Is there anything you could share with us?
Yeah, well, candidly, you know, we did invite a number of people who were based in Central Asia, and for various reasons, they were unable to accept our invitation. And we're certainly interested in bringing in people to our advisory council who are based in Central Asia. And so we have a number of people we've now reached out to who are waiting to hear back from to add to our advisory council. Yeah, we obviously have a number of members of the advisory council, as you said, and the board who are from Central Asia, but most of them are not based in Central Asia. So that's certainly something that we are keenly aware of and are in the process of addressing, you know, to bring in, you know, a lot of people within the broader research network that we're establishing are based in Central Asia, but no one on the advisory council at present.
Perhaps we can get Neva's thoughts here. I mean, as much as this initiative is promising, it also has challenges when it comes to working in Central Asia. As someone, you are based in Central Asia and already involved in the sort of things that will be featured in OCCIS's work going forward. So what kind of challenges you expect in Central Asia for this society?
I think, you know, Cher has, you know, completely pointed out, you know, the one challenge that I think any foreign researcher here face is, you know, finding, you know, a Central Asian researcher that trusts you and that you can trust them. I think this is really difficult. And most of the time, you know, Shai is right. They don't want their names to be included. Hmm. I had a really hard time finding someone in Uzbekistan that could do some interviews for me. They, you know, wasn't sure, you know, what I was doing. I think there wasn't trust there. Like, I think it's so easy to just think, oh, is this, you know, for a foreign government? Because, I mean, these things do happen in the region. So people are cautious. So most of the time, it just circle back to, you know, the few, you know, very, the more, you know, high profile researchers or scholars in the region, and because they have already their people that they trust and that the relationship they have built whenever they were here. So I think for new researcher like myself, I've worked in this region for 2 years now. This is still something that I'm working on and I'm constantly trying to improve, is, you know, finding people that I trust and that also trust me. But luckily for me, my focus is on China, which, you know, most of the time I'm okay, you know, forging my own Chinese, you know, network. And, you know, that's the kind of people that are my targets more than, you know, for example, security personnel in the Kyrgyz government, for example. That wouldn't be my, you know, research target. But the challenge is, you know, if I do need, you know, the kind of Central Asian angle, there is still a big challenge. I think OCCIS, what it attracts is really, you know, people in Central Asia that are willing to work, because there are really young Central Asians, you know, just graduated from the academy, for example, or, you know, the American university, you know, who are really willing to work, but they just don't have the access to scholars. And, you know, oftentimes they probably don't have the experience as well. So you have to really kind of train them or something, which is something that I think OCCIS can easily do, run some sort of online training programs for these really new kind of up and coming Central Asian researchers who, you know, go down to the field and find information. Because most of the time, you know, what I witness here is, you know, if a foreign researcher, for example, I know this case about a Dutch researcher that came here to do aging research on Kyrgyz society. And, you know, this researcher, you know, basically, you know, went to the American university and asked, you know, the anthropology department to, you know, get a referral of someone that this researcher wants to work with. And this is how these jobs are kind of, you know, circulate around. It's all about personal kind of relationships. So I think, you know, the OCCIS society will really break this down, because, you know, people that are willing to work and our experience will find OCCIS society, you know, a good platform. As Ed says, like, you know, they won't have to rely on these, you know, very traditional personal relationships anymore, which they are, you know, still really good and strong. But I think by having, you know, the OCCIS platform, you can really expand research really easily, because you just have people available. Because I spend so much time, you know, finding people to work with, and it's just sometimes some projects might not happen because I just, you know, can't get certain interviews or I can't get certain access to something.
Right.
And this is, you know, a barrier that OCCIS will really, you know, try to help with.
Yeah. As they really
Mohammed, if I may chime in and piggyback off of Neva's comments, in terms of attracting local researchers and, you know, sort of helping them getting from under the shadow and, you know, making them part of this project, I think another critical point that I think we at OCCIS aim to make, and I hope we will make in the future, is, you know, letting all these local researchers know that we at OCCIS are not interested in the old narratives, and we're looking to redefine the region, and we're looking to bring in new, fresh voices from the ground. Some of the Central Asian researchers that I spoke to who are on the ground right now, there's a certain awareness from them, from their region constantly being defined as Russia's backyard or as China's doorstep or as America's strategic interest, you know, and all of this research kind of forgetting that Central Asian countries have their own agendas. There are some exciting things happening on the ground, grassroots developments and things like that. And I think one of the important things that we could do at Oxus is signal to those researchers that we want to hear those points of view. We want to bring them in into the fold.
Yeah. These are very important points that you are making, both of you, Niva and Cher. But how to make it? How to make it possible? I mean, there is this stereotype in Central Asia. Whenever you reach out to someone, the first question is that you face with is, you know, why me and what you want? There's a certain level of suspicion. And also, Edward, I understand from your point that you are trying to bring new people, new voices into the debate. So how to get to them? How to build this trust? How to build this bridge? And is there anything, Edward, you have in mind to make this happen?
Oh, I think Niva and Cher sort of made excellent points. And, you know, I think it'll be, as Cher said, with a number of his people he spoke to and other people I've spoken to on the ground, there is a sort of desire to see, well, what does this look like? You know, what will the website look like? What sort of events and content will you be posting? And then sort of people can make a judgment as to whether they want to join publicly. As I said before, you know, I think we're certainly very interested in involving people, even if they're not happy revealing their identity to a broader sort of audience and network. And so, you know, there are certain strategies we can include people in activities. For example, you know, we have authors working on two reports that we're working on for the US Institute of Peace, both of whom are remaining anonymous. You know, they're going to get credit for the work, but unfortunately they don't feel comfortable revealing their identities. So there's certainly, you know, there's, as I said, keeping members of our network safe is our key priority. And so, you know, we are happy to adopt certain practices to make sure that, you know, those people's identities are kept safe. You know, and I think, you know, in terms of building trust, the extent to which we can start having publications in local languages and, you know, doing certain things to move us away from being a sort of organization that's purely associated with sort of the West and Western opinions, you know, that would obviously help us maybe break down those barriers and include people.
Thank you. So what's next? What's the next in the immediate future once the project is officially launched on September 28th? Let's continue the debate talking about these and many other questions very shortly. But first, let me recap the Majlis podcast that today I'm joined by Edward Lemon, the president of the Oxus Society, also research assistant professor at the Bush School, Shir Hashimov, an independent researcher focusing on Central Asia, originally from Tajikistan, Niva Yao, researcher at the OSC Academy in Bishkek, and Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. I am Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C., and we are discussing a new initiative, the Oxus Society, that aims to foster and strengthen the academic exchange between Central Asia and the world. So, Edward, again, let me start with you. I'm really trying to give you a platform to explain this project. I guess I hinted earlier. So there are so many other NGOs in the field, inside and outside Central Asia, which are active in similar fields. Why you thought there's a need for another one?
Well, I think, you know, we are certainly similar to certain other organizations, such as the Central Asia Program and Central Eurasian Studies Society, you know, the Khabar Network based in Central Asia, insofar as, you know, we are going to be organizing events, we're going to be publishing research reports, research articles. But I think we do differentiate ourselves in a number of ways. I think the first is sort of our focus on data visualization. So with the protest map that Cher spoke about earlier, protest tracker, you know, we plan to visualize that on an interactive protest map where there'll be geo points with the protests where you can click and find a description. There'll be different layers where you can sort the protests by different issues that are being contested, such as, you know, protests related to China, protests related to welfare, protests related to COVID-19, and also the response, you know, so you can map out, well, where did the arrests take place? You know, coupled with that, we're also going to be presenting data sets on in an interactive map of arms transfers to the region, a sort of interactive visualization of joint military exercises with external partners. You know, so I think, you know, when we looked at other organizations working in the field, you know, we felt that there was a gap in terms of presenting data in visually appealing ways that can appeal to a broad audience. I think that's something that China Studies, for example, is doing very well, but Central Asian Studies wasn't doing as well. You know, I think a second way that we're differentiating ourselves is very specifically sort of obviously framing the region as being interesting in and of itself, but particularly stressing the external linkages to the East with China, but also with Japan and Korea. That's why on our advisory council we have Timur Dadabayev, who's based at Tsukuba University in Japan and done some of the leading research on Japan and Korea's connections with the region, and also to the south with India. So we have Punchok Stobdan, who was the former Indian ambassador to Kyrgyzstan and shaped India's policy towards the region, on our advisory council as well. So we're very interested in moving away from sort of the focus on the region's linkages with Russia and with the West. So yeah.
It's a huge project, Edward, and I understand this is a bipartisan platform, but you need funding. I mean, where do you get funding for this?
Well, initially we were and are self-funded, but moving forward, we've secured some financing from the U.S. Institute of Peace, and we've filed for 501c3, which is charitable status in the United States, which will allow us to apply for funding from a number of other donors. So at this point, we've sort of secured the first few months of funding for various reports and activities and a workshop, hopefully in the new year. But, you know, going forward, we're actively going to be seeking funding from various different sources.
Mm. And Bruce, I have so many questions. I also don't like to dominate the discussion. If there's anything you would like to jump in here, just please go ahead.
I'm fascinated to listen, because I have I wanted to know so much about this since I first saw the first tweet come out. So I'm happy to hear all these, what everyone has to say about this. I'm just curious. I mean, most of the topics that you talked about were political, security, something like that. You know, I don't have to tell you, there's a lot of great anthropologists out there, both local and people that are from the West but lived out there. And Edward, you were kind of such a person yourself once upon a time. Are you going to bring out more of that, you know, about what local culture, you know, eccentricities and unique traditions among some of these things? Because every now and then you see something like that, but most of these reports are huge. You know, I mean, you have to download the files or something like that. I know officially you will open it up to anthropologists. Are you actively seek out these kind of people, especially locals who are doing the work, you know, down there in the villages and all those places?
No, thank you, Bruce. No, I think historians, anthropologists, as I say, are sort of part of our broader project. I think initially, you know, most of our outputs are sort of focused on, as you say, contemporary political and security concerns, but we're certainly very interested in featuring work from anthropologists. In fact, we have a piece hopefully coming out on the website around launch time on sort of the everyday dynamics of counter-extremism in Kazakhstan and the ways in which the Kazakhstan's government's response, and this fieldwork was done in, I think, in Aktau and Januaza and in the west of the country, that the sort of simulations and various sort of exercises that were done in the name of counterterrorism and counter-extremism, in fact, engendered more fear in the local population than, you know, the extremist threat itself, you know, which is something obviously I've worked on myself on in the context of Tajikistan. So we're certainly, you know, very interested in featuring reports and articles by anthropologists. We also are hopefully planning a report that will be based on a sort of an anthropological analysis by multiple authors of a specific town in Xinjiang and how it's changed over the past decade as a result of, you know, the sort of response to the riots and then subsequent sort of crackdown with the detention camp. So we're certainly, you know, it fits our approach to be showcasing sort of local voices and new voices to, you know, be also bringing in anthropologists and others. And so
If I may add to what Ed just said and talk a little bit about cultural reporting on the ground, the same day that the Oxus website launches on the Monday, September 28th, we have a piece coming out in the Culver Journal, co-authored by Colleen Wood and I, where we spoke to young Tajik online activists, most of them feminism activists, about how their lack of civil war memories and the early access to the internet that they had, how that informs their identity, how it helps them break away from social taboos that exist in Tajikistan, and how that informs their online activism. And we certainly plan to keep exploring those topics, and I hope to publish a couple of reports like that with the Oxus Society.
Yeah, it's certainly fascinating, and I wish you good luck. We wish you good luck. And of course, our paths will cross more often than before as you launch the society. Just one final thing, Edward. So how do you see the project, let's say, in 1 year? Where do you see it? Edward, was it a second?
Hopefully we will have grown our network out to be able to organize, you know, regular, as I say, internal events for members of the researcher directory themselves, along with sort of public facing events. You know, I'd like to, you know, we've had a number of internal discussions around, for example, visualizing data on transnational repression The targeting of exiles, not just by the Central Asian regimes, but also by the Chinese government targeting Uyghur activists. So that's certainly something that we're talking with the Uyghur Human Rights Project about partnering with them on. So, I think, we have a number of ideas for different research projects, as I say, I want to bring in sort of more analysis or reports that are conducted by historians and anthropologists as well. So hopefully in a year's time, we will have established ourselves as a reputable organization that hopefully is known not only in small circles in the United States and Europe, but also relatively well known on the ground. And I think it'll fall upon us to actively have outreach to local media, local experts, as we've discussed on the podcast, to allow that to happen.
Right. Okay. Terrific. So I think with this, unfortunately, we have to conclude the conversation right here. So Edward Lemon, the president of the Oxus Society, thank you very much for joining us today. And also big thanks to Shir Hashimov, an independent researcher focusing on Central Asia, Neva Yao, researcher at the OSCE Academy in Bishkek, and Bruce Panier, the editor of RFRL Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. Thank you very much, colleagues, for your time and thoughts today. And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe Liberties media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. Until next week, bye-bye.